Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, July 5th, 1996. In the Creekside Room this morning, our speaker is Sherry Tone. Today's session number is 2 and is titled Sea Change, the Global Marine Environment. Let's listen in.
And my topic today is sea change. I want to talk a little bit about the global oceans. And I'm largely using the book that's been published about the last 8 months by Sylvia Earle, and it's called Sea Change. Sylvia Earle has been called the Sturgeon General of the United States because she served as the chief scientist for NOAA for a couple of years during the Bush administration until she got totally fed up with the process, not of being a part of the Bush administration, but of being part of the hierarchical structure that she didn't feel was responding appropriately to the seas. It's very interesting, though, what's happened to her. It was kind of like a life change for her to have served in that position, because since then she's become a very outspoken advocate for the oceans, much more so than she was before she served as the Sturgeon General. Her confirmation hearings, by the way, were very, very rough, too, although she was indeed confirmed. A lot of people say this book is as significant as Silent Spring was for pesticides, that this book really does get across to average people, if they'll read it, what the issues are with regard to today's world, to the oceans of today. Books that were very important to her included The Sea Around Us, which was written by Rachel Carson in 1963, and is absolutely a wonderful book if you haven't read it. Also, The Silent World of Jacques Cousteau, which was published in 1963, where Jacques Cousteau, it's his first real book where he talks about what it's like to be a scuba diver, to dive underwater, and what he saw. Interestingly enough, in The Silent World of Jacques Cousteau, he talks a lot about spearfishing, something today which he and his co-author Dumas absolutely abhor. But at that point in time, that was one of the challenges of being able to be underwater, was to be able to spearfish. The other very significant book to her, and actually to me too, is a book called Challenging the Deep by Hans Haas, who was kind of a compatriot of Jacques Cousteau's, lived about the same time as Jacques Cousteau, had his career over the same time as Jacques Cousteau, and writes a lot about going deeper and deeper and deeper in the oceans. A lot of what sea change is a call to action. But at the same time, Sylvia Earle is a real educator. She has a PhD in marine botany from Duke. And in her early years, the way she got into oceanography was by studying algae in the Florida Keys and then moving further and further afield. She's a very, very bright woman, and in many ways she was also very, very lucky, because she, in many cases, was the first woman to do this, the first woman to do that, the first woman to be able to go out on an oceanographic vessel with about 100 and some odd men, and got some rather unique headlines around the world, like, you know, housewife sails with 70 men and lives to tell about it, essentially. This book has a lot about the science of the oceans kind of woven through it, too. And on Monday, I talked about biodiversity and coral reefs, and it has a wonderful chapter on biodiversity, which I'm not even going to touch on today. It also has a very, very chilling description of the Gulf War and the effect of oil spills in the Persian Gulf. And that was at a point in time when she was chief scientist for NOAA. So she had direct access on the front lines to looking at how wells were capped and what kind of damage was caused, and direct access to talk to people like the Emirate of Kuwait, who was very concerned about getting fresh seafood for his mother because she didn't want seafood that was contaminated with oil. I do want to do some readings from this book, more than I normally would do, but she says it much better than I do. This is in the introduction, and she's being interviewed by a young woman in Melbourne, Australia, in 1976. And woman says to her, suppose the ocean's dried up tomorrow, why should I care? I don't swim, I hate boats, I get seasick, I don't even like to eat fish. Why should I object if some of them, or all of them, go extinct? Who needs the ocean anyway? Well, Sylvia replies, right, dry up the oceans. Just think of all the good stuff lost at sea that you could just scoop right up and find. The trouble is, there wouldn't be anybody around to do that. Without an ocean, there'd be no life, no people anyway. Well, how so, she prodded. People don't drink salt water. There's plenty of water in the universe, Sylvia replies, without life, but nowhere is there life without water. That's why the ocean matters. If the sea is sick, we'll feel it. If it dies, we die. Our future and the state of the oceans are one. In retrospect, questions posed by the tongue-in-cheek Australian were mild compared to the late grilling by many who did not see the relevance of the ocean to her everyday lives in her hearings, confirmation hearings before NOAA. I wondered what could jolt people out of their complacency, could make them notice the dangers of overfishing, the poisoning of the sea with toxic chemicals that return to us in intricate but inevitable pathways, and of blindly tinkering with the Earth's life support systems. 97% of water on the Earth is indeed in the oceans. And if we look at the habitat around the world, 95% of the biosphere is in the oceans. In other words, 5% of the biosphere is on the surface of the Earth. And that, of course, is because the surface of the Earth is essentially kind of a two-dimensional surface. We have a little bit of margin above the surface of the Earth, but not really very much where critters survive. In the oceans, on the other hand, critters can survive down to the deepest of the deepest trenches at 17,000 feet. So, between the deepest of the deepest trenches and the surface of the ocean, we have a huge volume that really has a lot of critters living in it, both plants and animals, as well as microscopic critters. The history of humans underwater is really quite short. We haven't been going underwater for very long at all. Some of the very earliest submarines, of course, were submarines used in war. The Civil War had some limited use of submarines, and of course, the site of the Monitor, which is one of the subs that sunk, is one of our marine parks today, a marine reserve. People use the oceans for sport diving. Sport is one of the uses. People have gone free diving to a depth of about 400 feet today, usually by tying lead weights on their ankles and going shoop down to 400 feet, letting the lead weights off and coming back up. It does take a while, however, to go to 400 feet. And there's an Italian guy who right now is trying to set the record by going to 500 feet. There are about 1 million sport scuba divers in the United States today. That number, however, is very much in flux because a lot of people start diving, get certified for diving, and drop out of diving for a variety of reasons, one of which, of course, is cost. Scuba diving is a very, very expensive sport. I've been diving since 1974, and I would hate to try and add up the amount of money I've spent on modernization of dive equipment, as well as getting to all the places I like to go diving where the water's warm. The waters have also been very important economically. Obviously, fishing, which I'm going to come back to and talk about at some length, but in a variety of other ways, too, which include things like pearl diving. Something women of Japan have done for probably 300 to 400 years, perhaps longer. Exploration. Some of the earliest exploration done of our oceans was Charles Darwin on the Beagle. The biggest, most famous oceanographic expedition of the 19th century was done by the ship Challenger in about 1872. And one of the things Sylvia Earle did in 1960, in the early 1960s, was they revisited many of the sites where the Challenger had gone in 1872. Many of these sites which had not been visited by any scientific expedition between 1872 and the 1960s. There's an enormous amount of science going on in the ocean. New species are being discovered to this day. We discover some new species on land, but not nearly at the rate one can discover them in the ocean, because there are so many more unidentified species under the water than there are on land, particularly of things like algae and subcellular organisms. But even new species of fish are being discovered on a relatively regular basis. In the history of humans underwater, there's some really neat creativity, too. Sometime go back and read a book you probably read in junior high school, written by Jules Verne, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, which is actually an amazing, amazing book in terms of being forward-thinking about the significance of the oceans. People have been trying to live under the sea since the early 1960s. Jacques Cousteau, first with Starfish House and then with Conchel 3, built habitats under the ocean. In the 1960s and 1970s, the U.S. Navy was very interested in habitats under the ocean, and at the same time we had astronauts, the Navy had Argonauts. Somehow Argonauts didn't catch on in quite the same way as astronauts, and there are really very few undersea habitats left. In her book, Sylvia Earle describes getting to live in one of the undersea habitats called Tektite, which was in the Virgin Islands, and how in 2 weeks of living in this habitat, she was able to do much, much, much more diving than she'd been able to do in the previous 12 or 14 years she'd been diving, just because she could just go out and dive all the time. Part of the reason, of course, for that is human physiology. We're really not designed to live underwater, and if we're underwater, our body becomes saturated with the gases we breathe. That's particularly significant with nitrogen, because the nitrogen is dissolved in your bloodstream when you're underwater, and then when you come up, it comes out of solution, out of the bloodstreams, and forms bubbles. That's called the bends. That's not good for you. People don't do well getting the bends. One can also have various kinds of embolisms, including air embolisms, where the bubble can end up lodged somewhere like your brain, which is also not very good for you. At that time when Sylvia was diving, saturation diving out of Tektite, she said, "If people could see what we see underwater, they would care about the place, but they can't if nobody tells them." She also describes critters that live in the ocean, like the leatherback turtle, and compares them to humans. In the 1970s, some folks put sensors on a leatherback turtle, a female leatherback turtle who weighed about 650 pounds, and let the leatherback turtle dive and followed it on dives. On one dive, this 650 pound female leatherback turtle went past the maximum reading on their gauge, which was at 3,300 feet. And they estimate the turtle went to 4,265 feet before she turned around. Nobody knows if turtles go to this kind of depth all the time, but they certainly can, and they certainly do on some regular basis. There are three orders of mammals in the oceans. One order of mammals are the Sirena, or mermaids, which include dugongs, manatees, sea cows, and of course the recently extinct Steller sea cow, which was hunted to extinction. You've all heard about the threats to the manatees in Florida. Sometimes they get hit by propeller blades, which leaves them with fairly serious wounds, but that's probably not what kills kills the average manatee. The average manatee is probably more likely to be killed by shockwaves going through the waters underwater, or from things like viral infections. Viral infections that they may get because of pollution, because of exposure to, you know, various kinds of things we put in the water from wastewater, various kinds of viruses that end up in the water from wastewater, that they catch. It's not really known, but a lot of manatees are indeed dying.
Excuse me?
Yes?
What are the shockwaves? Where are those from?
From impact, various kinds of impacts. Propeller impact, various things dropped in the water.
So just something dropping in the water can send a shockwave?
Not just something little dropping in the water, but something big, like a 9-ton anchor. Which is about the size of the average anchor on a cruise ship. A few years ago when I was in Belize, and there was a headline, and there are 5 newspapers in Belize City, and they range in politics from far right to far left. And one of the ones that is very environmentally friendly had a headline, "Manatee Murdered in Belize." It shows, the article showed how many Belizeans respond to the survival of the species of manatee that they have, that they really are extremely concerned about the survival of manatees. In other parts of the world, manatees and dugongs are indeed eaten. Another order of mammals that lives in the ocean are, of course, mammals that fall into the order Carnivora. We have 2 kinds of seagoing otters, those that we would commonly call river otters, which can live in the oceans, as well as sea otters, 18 species of seals, 14 species of sea lions and fur seals, and 78 species of dolphins and whales. In her book, Sylvia describes contact with humpback whales, which are kind of medium big whales. They're about half the size of our very biggest whales. And in the 1970s, her and some of her friends were able to get a permit to dive directly with humpback whales in Hawaii. And after that, they followed humpback whales from Alaska to Hawaii for a while. Humpbacks occur throughout the world, migrating annually from cold water feeding grounds in the tropics for courtship and calving. Planetary giants, sometimes 60 feet in length, they are larger than any of the dinosaurs and the gray and the minke whales, but less than half the size of the blue whales and smaller than fin, sperm, bowhead, right, and bride's whales. This is the description of the beginning of her first dive. Finally, the heart-stopping moment marking the true beginning of our project came. I was perched on the side of a small rubber boat several miles offshore from Maui, and I had to convince myself, not some funding organization, that it was a good idea to step into the sea with 4 actively curious humpbacks. Humpback whales have a reputation for gentleness, but I was unsure what 40 tons of gentleness might feel like. My first encounter was over in a minute as a large whale sped by me without touching. Then the same whale swam at Al Giddings, who she was diving with. Only this time, a collision between Al's head and one of the whale's wing-like flippers appeared certain. Al was oblivious of the impending disaster, as he was completely absorbed in filming the image of a more distant whale. Chuck hooted a warning, not wanting to witness a decapitation on her first day. But then, at the last minute, with a delf twist, the whale artfully lifted her flipper over Al's head, barely avoiding contact. I stopped worrying then, casting my fate to the whales. On Monday, I talked about biodiversity. And she has some really excellent chapters in here talking about species that we've essentially knocked out of the food chain or out of the food web by limiting biodiversity. And I'm going to come back to that a little bit later in talking about species of fish that are being depleted. But as she points out, humans respond to fish as hunter-gatherers. We have relatively small amounts of agriculturally raised fish, or quote, farm-raised fish. But rather, most of our fish species, much of our shellfish species, we gather from the wild. We rely on Mother Nature to provide us with those species. Today, of course, though, there's large-scale commercial tracking, catching, and marketing of these wild-caught fish. One of the places she visits in this book is the Tokyo Fish Market, the fish market where one bluefin tuna may go for $100,000 to $500,000 and end up being served as sushi in Japan at $75 a plate for two pieces of sushi. She points out, however, that there are many fish markets around the world, and she doesn't pick on the Tokyo fish market particularly, doesn't mean to pick on the Tokyo fish market particularly, but just that the Tokyo fish market is the biggest fish market and perhaps does some of the more unpleasant things. No free lunch. A Delft slice with a fresh honed knife exposed dark red flesh and pale bone near the tail of a struggling silver and blue fish, a young amberjack that had just been transported alive to the world's largest fish market in Tokyo and was one of more than a million sea creatures offered for sale there each day. With surgical precision, the shopkeeper rammed a long needle-like skewer down the fish's spinal column, causing instant paralysis but slow death. Freshness brings premium prices, and this mode of killing ensured the fish's eyes would remain bright and clear, the flesh less bruised than if it were allowed to flop about. Each year, approximately 1 million tons of animals transit through the Tokyo market to supply Japan's taste for hundreds of variations in the theme of raw, smoked, steamed, fried, dried, grilled, baked, braised, boiled, and broiled creatures captured and taken from the sea. In fact, I knew from hundreds of ominous signs the collapse of major fisheries and sharp declines by many others could affect this market in the long run. Even familiar staples of the early part of this century, cod, herring, haddock, pollock, halibut, several kinds of salmon, and tuna, are in sharp decline after years of heavy fishing pressure. Echoing the fate of the once more abundant species of buffalo, passenger pigeons, and dozens of other tasty but vulnerable terrestrial species of birds and mammals. We're all very well of the tuna-dolphin controversies of the past, and concerns about tuna bycatch. And of course, today, after the exposés of videotapes we've seen of dead dolphin on tuna boats, dolphin-safe fishing has been developed. But she points out that dolphin-safe fishing uses nets that have rafts of logs and debris to hold the nets up, or to hold the nets down, so the dolphins can escape. In the past, if you had 1,000 net sets, for tuna around dolphin herds, you might, in 1,000 net sets, have 500 dead dolphins, 52 billfish, 10 turtles, and no sharks as the bycatch. Today, with dolphin-safe fishing, she points out that with 1,000 net sets, you might only have 2 dolphins, but a much larger number of other species. For instance, 654 billfish, as compared to 52, 102 sea turtles, and 13,958 sharks. So that's the result of dolphin safe fishing. The bycatch is a big issue in other industry and other kinds of fishing industries as well. And one of the ones she talks about is in the area of shrimp fishing, particularly in the Gulf of Mexico. For 8 to 10 pounds of Gulf shrimp, one may well have a bycatch of 80 to 100 pounds of, quote, trash fish, which can include rays, eels, flounder, butterfish, redfish, batfish, and juveniles of a whole variety of species. And unfortunately, most of those species are mangled beyond what could be consumed because of the nets for tuna, for the shrimp, and they're all discarded. Now, anybody from the Gulf? Redfish are indeed considered a threatened species today because of blackened redfish, and the harvest limits on them are very tight. But as part of the shrimp bycatch, there's essentially no regulation on them. So on one hand, they're tightly regulated. On the other hand, as a bycatch, they're largely unregulated. But in addition to these species of fish, these nets scrape along the bottom, and of course we have starfish, urchins, crabs, sand dollars, sponges, coral, conch, and a whole variety of other members of the floor community, the ocean floor community, that are scraped up. Okay, but even more significantly, it takes about 20 pounds of plants to make a pound of beef. If the animal is young and taken off to market before it's leveled off, reached its leveling off phase in growth. But to make a pound of 10-year-old Atlantic bluefin tuna, a magnificent, high-energy, open-water predator that may consume as much as 25% of its body weight in food each day. It eats 25% of its body weight each day. It takes thousands of pounds of fish that indeed have eaten tens of thousands of pounds of smaller fish and crustaceans, which have derived their energy from perhaps millions of pounds of minuscule plants through photosynthesis and turning of carbon dioxide into simple sugar molecules. In other words, 20 pounds of plants make a pound of marketable calf. Perhaps 100,000 pounds of phytoplankton move through the food web to make a 10-year-old marketable tuna. Tuna, swordfish, marlin, sailfish, bonito, and mackerel are considered by many to be among the most aesthetically pleasing, most elegantly formed creatures on the planet. Canned tuna, marketed for use in sandwiches, casseroles, and salads, is usually from the group of fish known as true tuna, which includes albacore, yellowfin, skipjack, or big-eye tuna. At least 14 other less well-known species are also in this group, as well as 50 species of fish that include things like the blue marlin. I've listened to engineers sigh with envy while admiring the streamlined and hydrodynamic refinements that allow some members of this group to speed through the sea, keeping pace with nuclear submarines. These species of tuna can go as fast as 50 miles an hour. The Western Atlantic bluefin tuna is a species where the population has declined to 10% of what it was 20 years ago when regulation of taking of these fishes began. So after regulation began 20 years ago, we now have 10% of the population we had at that point in time. By mid-1991, the years of fishing pressure on the tuna had created such a bleak future that Sweden proposed having the species declared endangered, a suggestion later withdrawn because of objections raised by Japan, the United States, and other countries with a strong economic interest in taking tuna. More than half of the total catch of bluefin tuna is taken by the U.S., which does much of the fishing, and Japan, which provides most of the market. Then a quote from her. If we humans are to make a successful, sustainable place for ourselves in the world, whether our population holds steady or doubles, it is mandatory that we establish effective food resources that minimize the impact to crucial natural resources and maximize the efficient use of food energy. The chances of making ecological ends meet on a diet of tuna, swordfish, grouper, snapper, sharks, and other large predators is about as great as the likelihood that we could make likelihood that we could make our feeding millions by eating panthers. If the oceans of the world are to continue to provide wild-caught food, we must provide a better understanding of the natural populations and apply this knowledge before they deteriorate to the point of no return. She goes on to talk about other species that have indeed crashed, such as the sardine population of Monterey Bay, which of course was the subject of Canary Row in Steinbeck's novel, which I highly recommend you read if you haven't, because in Steinbeck's novel, all of the land-based characters, the people, represent different parts of the ecosystem of Monterey Bay. But essentially, that population collapsed. And after that population collapsed, after that fishery collapsed, it's never come back. There are a few sardines, but for whatever reason, they appear to have lost their niche in the ecosystem. Or perhaps there just aren't enough of a genetic gene pool, a viable gene pool left for them to be able to reproduce to continue to go back to occupying that space in the ecosystem. As she puts it, right now, our federal and international fisheries regulations are not regulating fisheries at maximal sustainable yields, but essentially following Garrett Hardin's tragedy of the commons, where we mine out one fish species, then move on to mine out another fish species. I feel like I've been a part of that. And a good example of it are the crabs in Alaska, where one period of time in the early 1980s in Seattle, king crab was on every menu in every restaurant, and you could get great crab legs just about anywhere. Think about it on restaurants today, menus today. Two or three menus in all of Seattle maybe have king crab legs, and they're at the top of the price list rather than the bottom of the price list.
Question?
Yeah.
What did you mean when you said that the sardines in Monterey Bay may have lost their niche? Would another species come in to fill that?
That other species may have come in to fill it. People who've studied the sardines really can't figure out why they haven't come back. You know, they migrate out into the oceans and then they return. And they can tag little critters and they migrate out into the oceans and they return. But they've never come back.
Now, did that happen with larger species?
It appears to have happened with many species of salmon. That certainly, while loss of habitat has been very critical, having a critical mass of just number of salmon that are spawning and going to sea, it appears to have also happened. That some species which are still strong may well have displaced the species that have dropped off in population. Yeah?
Were you implying that sardines were located only in that particular area of the world then? Or are there other areas where sardines still exist?
There are other areas where sardines still exist, but that population
was completely
mined out.
Should we be picking a can of sardines off the grocery store shelf? Or are we contributing here to?
Sylvia Earle would tell you that if you pick a can of sardines off the grocery store shelf, you're continuing to contribute to the demise. Although I didn't, I'm not going to read you the quote, but she has a fairly long section in here where she describes her family in Florida. She grew up in Florida. Part of her family lives in Florida now, and going out for a big seafood dinner at their favorite seafood restaurant, and how does she make choices on the menu? You know, looking at things like redfish and the other species of fish she ate as a kid, and thinking, do I really want to eat those? And if I have a choice between that and farm-raised catfish, which am I going to choose? She doesn't say which she chose. But having been around her, I could be willing to bet it wasn't the redfish. Yeah?
What about that issue of farming, sea farming? I know that in our area it's been more controversial about pros and cons of that.
She, absolutely, because in many cases the impact of sea farming has a very dramatic local effect on the area directly underneath it and the area directly around it. In Puget Sound right now, we have a lot of Atlantic salmon that have escaped from the net farms. And people are saying, you know, what effect does it have? Well, it appears that one thing it's done is introduce disease into the wild population, because the Atlantic salmon are farmed in a very enclosed space. They're given antibiotics in their food in some cases, and then later on, should they escape and have resistance to disease, they can carry along things that, you know, affect wild species. On the other hand, if you take a look at shell fishing, we've really been fairly successful in cultivating many forms of shellfish. And in Puget Sound, we wouldn't have the shellfish we have if there weren't companies that were literally farming the beaches or raising them on strings on floats to grow shellfish. I'm personally not a fan of eating farm-raised salmon. I mean, I don't like the idea particularly of eating salmon that's fed salmon chow. On the other hand, I probably eat all kinds of terrestrial species that are fed various kinds of chicken chow or, you know, I don't even want to think about some of the things that cows are fed. When I was in Minnesota, there were some very unique experiments going on things you could feed to cows. So I don't think there's a simple answer about farm raising species.
Become a vegetarian.
What?
Become a vegetarian.
Yeah, right. Shrimp, for instance, that are grown in Honduras and Guatemala, struck me as, you know, a fairly good way for Hondurans and Guatemalans to earn capital on a fairly high market good, a good that sells for a fairly high price. But unfortunately, two bad things happen when you try and raise shrimp in ponds. One is generally mangrove swamps are cleared out to provide the ponds for growing the shrimp. And right now they don't have any way to spawn the mature shrimp, so the way they get their babies is by going out and trawling with very fine nets. And of course they have a lot of bycatch of other babies that they don't particularly want, plus of course they smash a lot in the process of catching them in the fine nets and dumping in the shrimp ponds. So, I mean, you're right, a person who mentioned becoming a vegetarian, all of this has its cost.
Coming back to the niche, is it necessarily a problem long term if another species can fill a niche that's been cleaned out, for example, by overfishing?
It kind of depends on where that species falls in the food chain. Because whatever preys on that species, or on the original species, may no longer have a food source. And the difficulty is, we don't know enough about it to be able to say, are we taking something out of the food web by overfishing this species or that species?
Don't you think
it kind of becomes analogous to situations on land where the ecosystem gets thrown out of balance and a species, you know, like we didn't used to have possums in this country, but somehow the ecosystem is out of balance now and they're everywhere. We didn't used to have Scotch broom in this country, but somehow, you know, the introduction of that, because there's nothing else that, you know, keeps it under control, makes it just go wild. And so isn't that kind of a...
And the interesting thing about, you know, it's even more complicated than that, because the interesting thing about Scotch broom in western Washington is it grows up in habitats that would have traditionally been burned by Native Americans because they cultivated the camas root that lived under the oak trees. And think about western Washington and where we have all the Scotch broom is exactly the kind of place where you would have had wide open meadows with camas root growing. But that those wide open meadows would not exist without burning. Without burning them, they just turn into regular old Douglas fir forests. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Of course, it'd be one way to get rid of the Scotch broom. You can always shade it out. That's an issue with reed canary grass along stream banks too. We've taken away the trees that normally grow along stream banks. And in taking away those trees, we allow reed canary grass to grow up, which then plugs up the streams, which then causes upstream flooding. Yeah?
We also live in Seattle. Apparently you do. And fortunately, we live right on the water in West Seattle. And one of our joys there is to just going out in front of our house on a low tide and being able to get butter clams, gooey ducks, and that sort of thing. But last year, we had a strange phenomenon. They disappeared. Not that we do a lot of digging. No one does that so much. But we figured out something, and maybe whether they were right or wrong, seagulls were getting the clam shells, or the live clams, and then dropping them on the land and eating the meat. I don't know if this is anything that we should be concerned about, but the crop is gone, you know? And I'm wondering if that is happening in many other places.
Well, the other thing that's doing in the clams is a variety of viral infections like X inclusion virus, which is part of what caused the plummeting of the clam population, of razor clam population over on the coast.
Yeah.
And fortunately, they're coming back. We don't know where the X inclusion virus particularly came from. It came from Europe, it appears. But it infected all kinds of clam beds, killed off all kinds of clams. And now the populations are coming back. We don't know why it came in the first place. We don't know why it killed off the clams in the first place, and we don't know why the populations are coming back. But when you add that to the pressures of species that have kind of gone out of control, like seagulls, because they fit very well in a human niche, human-related niche, since we love to feed them French fries at places like Ivers, and provide them with garbage dumps to go get food, they could well be putting a serious pressure on clams. It's hard to say. I would argue that there are enough subtidal clams that the seagulls are never going to get that would provide kind of a population of seed for the clams, that it's probably something beyond the seagulls. But your butter clams in Seattle are, of course, not really monitored or studied very much because, of course, they're considered to be an area where sewage contaminates them to the point where they're not available for commercial harvest. Yeah.
If the author left the government because she was disenchanted, would she end up making any recommendations or suggestions on what kind of policies should be developed?
Yeah. You know, she's obviously made a point of not eating marine predators, and she doesn't eat marine predators. She did a fundraiser for us, for People for Puget Sound, this last March. It was a wonderful event. She's a very lucid, really superb speaker. But at our event, we served only filter feeders, plankton feeders. which meant it was a pretty wonderful event because it meant we had gooey duck, we had butter clams, we had three or four kinds of oysters, we had mussels. It was called Fruits of the Sea, and it truly was, because all of these critters are farm-raised, plus they all live very low on the food chain because they're all eating plankton. So she believes that if you're going to eat seafood, you ought to eat filter feeders. But more seriously, more significantly, marine sanctuaries are one of the areas that she considers very, very important. In 1972, when the U.S. government passed the Marine Sanctuaries Act, there were zero marine sanctuaries around the world. Today, there are about 1,200 marine sanctuaries. Now, that's not the only solution, but what marine sanctuaries do is provide an area that is at least managed and at most relatively untouched, and it depends very much on the marine sanctuary as to how much the sanctuary is used. And in her book, she describes creating the Monterey Bay Marine Sanctuary, which was a very interesting process. It was actually finally created in 1992. And a very good friend of mine who's retired from Seattle was the federal manager who was involved in creating that sanctuary. And he was caught in the middle as a standard federal employee where, you know, he had people saying, well, keep it as small as possible, and he had people saying, we'll make it as big as possible. And when they went to Monterey and held the hearings, the public overwhelmingly told them to extend that marine sanctuary into deep water. And it goes into water that's 10,000 feet deep, because it drops off fairly rapidly off that coast. And there are people in Monterey who recognize the significance of making sure that you really covered the ecosystem way out into the water rather than just protecting right along the edges, the fringes of the coast. Now, a place like Monterey Bay Marine Sanctuary is a multiple-use area. You know, fishing is regulated, but people use it for fishing, and they use it for boating, and they use it for taking large ships through and for moving cargo and, you know, for all the kinds of things that you use kind of open ocean for. So it makes it a managed space rather than a true reserve. A reserve is a space where people don't go and people don't use it. There are few reserves around the world as compared to sanctuaries. Some reserves do exist, and actually in the back of her book she has the best inventory of reserves around the world and sanctuaries around the world that I know of. She's really done a nice job of kind of listing where they are around the world. Many, like the marine sanctuary along the Great Barrier Reef was formed in 1975. And it was the second really big, significant marine sanctuary legislation passed in the world after the U.S. marine sanctuary legislation. And it has some problems with it, partly because it was formed pretty early and partly because its management zones allow for too little reserve and too much that is available for human exploitation. And Australia is right now in the process of beginning to tweak that. But what you're seeing around the world is the creation of marine sanctuaries. Even Indonesia and Malaysia are creating marine sanctuaries. Unfortunately, they suffer very heavy poaching pressure. In the Caribbean, countries are creating marine sanctuaries because they see that there's a direct economic benefit in terms of being able to get scuba divers there. Scuba divers don't go to places where there aren't any fish. And a live fish that a diver can take a picture of is worth a heck of a lot more than a dead fish that a consumer eats once. And a lot of governments have figured that out. There's the island of Bonaire in the Netherlands Antilles. It's a very popular destination spot for divers. And there was one fish there, one French angelfish, that had a flaw in its eye. It was a very distinctive flaw, and anybody who'd seen this fish would recognize it. And I was at a slideshow one time, some people were showing their underwater slides, and I look at this fish and I say, I recognize that fish. They say, oh yeah, it's a French angelfish. And I said, no, I recognize that fish. You took that picture in Bonaire at such and such an anchorage. They said, oh yeah, we did. I mean, that is probably the most recognizable fish in the world. And people all over the world recognize that blasted fish. And it's been around that dive site for a good 10 years. And it just shows the value of one lousy French angelfish to the people of Bonaire in terms of the repeat business. And so she spends a lot of time talking about marine sanctuaries. She also spends a fair amount of time talking about NGOs, non-governmental organizations. And I've come to believe that these are absolutely critical in protecting marine habitats. On a local basis, little groups like one I'm involved with in Tacoma, Washington, called Citizens for a Healthy Bay, has begun to make a real difference in terms of a very urban estuary where people have done awful things to it for 150 years. But, you know, little by little, we can look at little hunks of habitat along the shoreline and try and be sure that they're protected and restored. On a regional and a national basis, we have organizations like the Center for Marine Conservation, which is was absolutely key in the whole issue of protection of dolphins and tuna fishing, and got very involved in the whole dolphin-free tuna controversy. On an international basis, we have organizations like Greenpeace, and not in terms of the anti-nuke stuff Greenpeace has done, which is certainly significant, but Greenpeace has actually been very effective in looking at fisheries management in the North Pacific and has probably done a better job of national and international lobbying than any other group in the world in terms of North Pacific fisheries management. Because Greenpeace is willing to send people to Japan to harass the Japanese, willing to send people to Indonesia or Malaysia to harass the fishermen from there who may move north, Washington, D.C., et cetera, around the world. So it's an international organization. The unfortunate thing about Greenpeace and many other NGOs, though, is their sticking power and whether they can really stick to an issue or choose to move on to another one. And that's the downside. Greenpeace has tended to do that. They'll look at North Pacific fishing for a while, and then they'll go off and send everybody to the South Pacific to protest the French bombing tests, and then remember to come back to pay attention to North Pacific issues. In terms of governmental action, in the U.S. we have a law called the Magnuson Act, which was passed in 1972, which extended our fishing, our economic zones to 200 miles offshore. The Magnuson Act did amazing things in terms of getting international fishing people out of our waters, but it's probably been more detrimental to fishing on the whole than not having the Magnuson Act, because what it did was allow U.S. fishermen much broader access than they previously had by lowering the cost of their licenses and providing them with subsidies for fishing. So we saw a huge explosion in our fishing fleet after the Magnuson Act was passed. And of course that's now collapsed, and we have our harbors full of fishing boats that don't have anywhere to fish. UNEP and UNESCO, the United Nations Environmental Program, and various other groups associated with the United Nations are one of the few entities that have really kept track of international fishery stocks. And that's one thing we need to do a lot better job of. But UNEP and UNESCO have helped in terms of providing resources for countries to be able to establish sanctuaries. Just in closing here, and I'll shut up. Sylvia makes the point that, you know, one person can do an enormous amount of damage with a bulldozer or drift nets, or in the case of Saddam Hussein, to the whole fisheries of the Persian Gulf, but one person can also make a significant difference. As she puts it, shall I or shall I not provide a market for shark steak or swordfish by ordering them in a restaurant? Shall I or shall I not drop a bottle or cup or bag of trash into the ocean? Shall I or shall I not vote for this person or that? Shall I spend $10 on a movie or send $10 to an organization that's tried to clean up the coastline? Shall I bend over to pick up a piece of junk from the beach? Traditionally, the sea has been regarded as a common heritage for all mankind. Now it must be acknowledged as a common responsibility. Comments, questions, other thoughts? Yes.
You commented on the Center for Marine Conservation and the work they've done on dolphin safe tuna fishing. Earlier in your presentation, you talked about the downside of that successful effort.
Actually, they've been very, they have been very analytical in approaching dolphin safe fishing. So I didn't mean to imply that they had advocated dolphin safe fishing. They've actually gone one step beyond that and criticized the quote dolphin safe fishing. And they've done a great job. Their chief scientist is a guy named Elliot Norris, who they're located in Washington, D.C., but he's figured out a scam where he lives in Seattle. And he has written, edited a really superb book on biodiversity in the oceans, one of the first ones that has really kind of gathered together what little information we have. It's available from Earth Island Press. Yeah.
Now, what federal agency sets catch limits on various species?
Department of Commerce sets it, and in many cases, there are treaties negotiated with other countries.
Now, how did the Magnuson Act, did the Magnuson Act then direct the Department of Commerce to allow certain limits? In other words, our coastal waters now have been depleted by overfishing.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody screwed up.
Mm-hmm.
How did that come about?
Well, it's very complicated because each fishery stock, fishery stocks are regulated by different entities. So it's like there's no fish guru that's responsible for all fisheries.
Oh.
And so, like, we have treaties with Canada on salmon. And we also have treaties with tribal people in the U.S. who are involved, and bands in Canada are involved. And then, of course, Alaska has different fishing interests than does Washington and Oregon. So the state of Washington, the state of Oregon, the state of Alaska, and Canadians, and the U.S. State Department are all involved in these fisheries, they're not called councils, fisheries groups that get together and negotiate what the catch limits are going to be. And Alaska right now is particularly mad at Oregon and Washington because Oregon and Washington have allowed habitat destruction to the point where our runs, of course, are pretty much gone. Well, unfortunately, all those fish commingle in the North Pacific. And a lot of those fish commingle as they then start to run back toward rivers and streams. And so the Canadians get irked because their runs in the Fraser River are really strong, but their Fraser River fish are mixed with our Columbia River fish in the offshore fishery. So if somebody goes out and catches Fraser River fish, they get 100 Fraser River fish and one Columbia River fish, they probably wiped out that run on the Columbia. So just that little area is extremely complex, you know, trying to sort out those issues. Then at the same time, you add tuna, and you add halibut, and you add pollock, and you add haddock, and you add, all the other species we catch in the North Pacific, and each one of those is individually regulated.
Then what happened off of Newfoundland?
In the Grand Banks?
Yeah.
That was another treaty. She actually talks about that in here. I don't understand that treaty very well. But essentially it was the same thing. There were fishery standards set on how many fish could be caught. And of course that was on the early side of fish management. That was in the early days of fish management. But there were fisheries limits that were set, and unfortunately the fisheries limits that were set were in such a way that the stock was done in. There are no fish left. That's the long and short of it. And that seems to be the way we manage every fishery. You know, bluefin tuna is a perfect example where it's very well documented. The sardines are an excellent example. If you go to Central and South America today, you know, the fishery stocks down there, same kind of thing. They're now at 10% of what they were 5 years ago or 20 years ago or 100 years ago, depending on the fishery. We've done the same thing with pollock in the North Pacific and the Bering Straits. Same thing with king crab. You know, it just kind of goes on and on. So the people who are now, who were king crab fishermen have now moved on to trying to fish something else because the king crab aren't there anymore. And they're going out in riskier and riskier weather and shorter and shorter seasons.
Okay, so who out there, I think to this question, who out there sort of, you know, working up the learning curve on this and saying, hey guys, you know, we've done this about 50 times already, let's learn our lessons and apply them. Everybody seems to be focused on 1 to 2 years out. Nobody's thinking 30-year life cycles here.
You hit the nail on the head, and unfortunately, right now, governmentally, it's not happening.
Because everybody's on a 4-year election cycle, so they're not thinking 30 years out.
Yeah.
Getting back to another problem, what has been done now in internationally in terms of the dumping of just ship trash over, I recall so vividly in the late 60s when I was on an aircraft carrier, that all of our stuff went off the back, all the garbage went off the back, even in the Navy. What extent has that been?
We have a treaty, there's an international treaty called MARPOL 5, which is a marine treaty that limits plastic being dumped off ships, and it actually pretty much works. Now, there are ships where it doesn't work that still dump their plastic off, and of course, people who are poaching fish probably aren't going to be worried a whole lot about where they're dumping their plastic either. But the regular container ships, for instance, that go from here to Japan or here to Korea, do a pretty good job of regulating their plastic dumping. One of my friends right now is on a cruise she just left, where she rides a container ship from here to Guam to, I think, Manila, eventually ends up in Australia, and then she'll fly back. And the reason she does, it's low-cost oceanography. She gets to sign up on a container ship and go out and take her measurements and essentially goes the same place that she'd go on an expensive U.S. NOAA ship, except that NOAA ships don't do that anymore to the same extent. And what she's trying to do is train the crew so that they will then take the measurements every time they're out sailing across the ocean. And these are, you know, salinity and just standard oceanographic measurements related to a global warming project out of Scripps. Well, last year when she was out, she lost her tennis shoes. She didn't know where they were. And she was sure they were in her bunk room somewhere, but she just couldn't find them. And so she was wearing these other shoes, and one of the guys in the ship said, well, what happened to your new tennis shoes? And she said, oh, they didn't fit, so I threw them overboard. And she said, he just about died. She said it was great to see his response, because it was like, you threw those shoes overboard, I could be thrown in jail for that. She said it just made her day. But that it was completely different than when she was on a ship 10 years ago. And the tennis shoes would have gone overboard. So the mainstream U.S. ships and ships with fairly well-educated crews are doing pretty well. But like I say, her concern when she's traveled are on ships with foreign-speaking crews who pretty much don't have a clue, and the shipping lines that are economically on the margin. One of the things that we're trying to do with the group I'm involved in Commencement Bay, which gets about 200 foreign flag carriers a year in, is get information translated into each of those languages and then send someone on board ship when they come in to actually give the crew a packet of information in their own language to read about appropriate behavior when they're in Commencement Bay.
Have they regulated the military ships too? Is that?
Yeah, the military ships are doing a much better job. They don't put any plastic overboard anymore. Submarines, I was on a Trident sub a while back and looked at the garbage system on a Trident sub, and they use a trash compactor to compact their garbage into little pellets, about like so, and then they put lead weights on them and they still shoot them into the ocean bottom. So they've still got some significant issues. But most of the other ships are doing a much better job. Plus, the military finally figured out that if they threw their garbage overboard, people could figure out where they were going. I mean, the Russians were collecting American garbage and taking a good look at it.
As a local practical example of what you're talking about, who regulates the fishing? Last year there was no salmon fishing allowed. We live out in Olympic Peninsula. And so all of the resorts had to close down, and all of their old clientele simply got on the ferry and went 15 miles across to Canada and caught all the salmon they wanted, because Canada did not shut down the fishing. So they sat in the resort and literally looked across the waters and watched all these boats over there catching the salmon that they weren't allowed to, to hook in on the American side. So it does get to be craziness. The other piece is that it sounds like the environmental groups need to get together, because the other night you were talking about eating McDonald's hamburger, and I know that a lot of the young people I know that talk about being vegetarians, but they do eat fish, because they have the message they shouldn't be eating that beef you were talking about the other night.
It's remarkably revealing to me. This is a message in Minnesota I think a whole lot about, but it's really wonderful too.
Something I've really gained an appreciation for in the last couple of years in terms of sustainability is you know, eating locally.
Yeah.
You know, supporting whatever crops or whatever are kind of indigenous, or at least grow well in your local situation, so that you don't have to truck stuff as far, thus saving, you know, gas and carbon dioxide output. But also, it's just more sustainable. I mean, a lot of the problems we're talking about with overfishing the oceans are, you know, fishing it for resale value to a worldwide market. And if we kind of ate within our own ecosystem, I think we'd do a lot better.
Well, and that hits the nail on the head in terms of pollution. She has some good chapters in here on environmental marine pollution, and that actually is the area that I know the most about. But, you know, I have all these people say to me, well, I won't eat a fish out of Commencement Bay because of all the pollution there. It's like, well, why would you expect that a fish coming from somewhere else is any less polluted? I mean, what do you know about the history of that other fish? So if you won't take care of your own bay to get safe fish, why should you expect somebody else to take care of their bay to provide you with safe fish? You know, particularly when you think about fish coming from Thailand, Indonesia, Malaysia, Taiwan, Korea, etc., and industrial pollution or industrial outfalls with much, much lower rate of control of pollutants than we have on our outfalls. I mean, I would be fairly concerned about a can of clams from Thailand myself, just in terms of chemical potential for chemical contamination. Thanks. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.